hear Huey Long, Greg Palast, Chris Hedges, and Samantha Power. So, first, let's start with Huey Pierce Long. Huey Pierce Long Jr., nicknamed the Kingfish, was an American politician from the U.S. state of Louisiana. A Democrat, he was noted for his radical populist policies. He served as governor of Louisiana from 1928 to 1932 and as a U.S. senator from 1932 to 1935. Though a backer of Franklin D. Roosevelt in the 1932 presidential election, Long split with Roosevelt in June 1933 and allegedly planned to mount his own presidential bid. Long created the Share Our Wealth program in 1934 with the motto, Every Man a King, proposing new wealth redistribution measures in the form of a net asset tax on large corporations and individuals of great wealth to curb poverty and crime resulting from the Great Depression. Charismatic and immensely popular for his social reform programs and willingness to take forceful action, Long was accused by his opponents of dictatorial tendencies for his near total control of the state government. At the height of his popularity, the colorful and flamboyant Long was shot on September 8, 1935, at the Louisiana State Capitol in Baton Rouge. He died 2 days later at the age of 42. His last words were reportedly, God, don't let me die. I have so much to do. And now, here is Huey Pierce Long.
Our United States government, under the auspices of Woodrow Wilson, then the president, undertook to find out what was the trouble in America with the people generally. They appointed an industrial relations commission headed by Frank P. Walt of Kansas City, Missouri. They made an intensive study, and at the conclusion of that study, they reported that the chief cause and the chief trouble with America was that a small percent of the people owned a large percent of the wealth. Now, you'll find that in the report of 1916 published by Congress. In other words, Woodrow Wilson's administration in 1916 said, too few have too much, too many have too little. They gave a table. They said that 2% of the people own 60% of the wealth. They said there's a middle class of 33% that owns 35% of the wealth. They said that 65% of the people own less than 5% of the wealth. That 2 million people own more than 110 million people. That was the finding of our industrial conference, serving under the appointment of Congress and Woodrow Wilson, the president. And it says, I propose a limitation on the size of fortune, both ways. I propose a limitation on how big a fortune can get, and a limitation on how little a fortune can get. I propose that a third the average is the smallest. One-third the average is the smallest. I propose that none should be over a few millions of dollars. A capital levy tax to be levied. The first 1 million not to be taxed except as it is now taxed. The second million to be taxed 1%. The third million 2%. The fourth million 4%. The fifth million 8%, the sixth million 16%, the seventh million 32%, the eighth million 64%, the ninth million 100%. To me, that no man with that tax levied against him every year can possess a fortune of more than from $3 to $4 or $5 million to any one man. Now, what's that going to mean? That's going to mean that within 2 or 3 years' time, the United States finds the treasure of the United States in possession of $165 billion of the wealth of this country. $165 billion at the minimum. Then, we start from the bottom. That the 25 or more million American families shall have a homestead. Louisiana has a homestead. Florida has a homestead. Texas has a homestead. That every citizen in the United States shall have a homestead. Up to $5,000. One-third the average wealth per family. Not like Mr. Brisbane said, when a man has to mistake the facts, he's probably run out of argument. My friend Arthur Brisbane, don't state the facts any longer. He argued with me a while, but he couldn't meet the facts. Now he has to misstate the facts, just 20-1 for the truth. In other words, 19/20 of what Mr. Brisbane says is a lie, and 1/20 is the truth. That's all. We're not going to destroy the Gulf Refining Company. We're not going to destroy the Standard Oil Company. But we're going to say that the limit of any one man's stock ownership in the Standard Oil Company is from $3 to $5 million to that individual, and that the balance of the people of America own the balance of what the Standard Oil Company is worth. All right. Then what are we going to do? We're going to guarantee if our plan succeeds, and it is, don't fool yourself, it's going to win this country. It's going to win this country, not 1940. It won in 1932, but we didn't get it, but we're going to win again, 36. We're going to say then, that every family in this country is entitled to the Florida and the Texas and the Louisiana homestead right, up to $5,000 or one-third the average. A home and the comforts of a home, including an automobile and a radio, the things it takes in that house to live on. 16. Now, if you have planted upon that table the food and the clothing and the products that it takes for 125 million people to live on, any man with a simple, full of sense ought to know that if you take 85% off of that table and give it to one man, that you're bound to have two-thirds of the people starving because they haven't got enough. How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able to feed the balance of the people is to make that man come back and bring back some of that grub he ain't got no business. Now we've got a barbecue. We have been praying to the Almighty to send us to a feast. We have knelt on our knees morning and night time. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We have asked the Almighty to fulfill that prayer of the Scripture, that he would smile on the field, give us rain in due season, and cause our fields the abundance necessary for life. And that prayer has been answered. There has been yielded too much to eat, too much to wear, everything to live in. The Lord has answered the prayer. He has called the barbecue. Come to my feet. He said to 125 million American people, but most, and Rockefeller and Mellon and Baruch and walked up and took 85% of the bills off the table. Now, how are you going to feed the balance of the people? What's Morgan and Baruch and Rockefeller and Mellon going to do with all that drug? They can't eat it. They can't wear the clothes. They can't live in the house. Give them a yacht. Give them a palace. Send them to Reno and give them a new wife. That's what you want. But when they've got everything on the God's living earth that they can eat, they can wear, they can live in, and all that their children can live in and wear and eat, and all their children can use, then we got to call Mr. Morgan and Mr. Mellon and Mr. Rockefeller back and say, come back here. Well, stuff back on this table here that you took away from here that you don't need. Leave something else for the American people to consume. And that's the problem. Now, my friends, I have in a rather belabored effort told you about everything I stand for, about everything I advocate in Congress. I can't anticipate all your questions. I won't undertake to do so. I would have loved in my early days to have had the opportunity. They don't quit depending on the newspapers. They don't know where they're coming or going. They don't know what to say. One day they say one thing, another day they say another. But you have the nucleus, the composite group of people here. Have the touch of the majority of the people of the United States. I'd like to have you, not supporting me. Maybe I can get along without it somehow or another. I'd like to have you study seriously, seriously, whether or not the American country is going to survive without we call into being what the Lord said had to be done. Whether or not an inequality, starvation among plenty, a nakedness in the land of too much, a homelessness amidst palaces, a luxury on the one hand, a pestilence on the other, whether or not we ought not to forget these big thinkers and let the people of America understand that whether you've got an NRA, or a JRA, or a PWA, or a GIN, or a JUGR, what? That nothing can survive, that nothing can advance against this abundance, against this plenty, against this except that we say to America, 125 million, none shall be too big, none shall be too poor, none shall work too much, none shall be idle. No luxurious mansion center, none walking the streets, none in poverty, none in pest, none in want, but in the land blessed by the smile of the Creator, with everything to be consumed, to be eaten, to be worn, that America will become a land sharing the fruits of the land, not for the favored few, not to satisfy greed, but that all may live in the land in which the Lord has provided an abundance sufficient for the luxury and convenience of the people in general. I pray.
Coming up next is Greg Palas and an excerpt from his book, The Armed Madhouse. Greg Palas is a New York Times best-selling author and journalist for the British Broadcasting Corporation, as well as the British newspaper, The Observer. His work frequently focuses on corporate malfeasance, but he's also been known to work with labor unions and consumer advocacy groups. In this tract, he talks about the beginning. like the cowardly dog he was.
The beginning, like the cowardly dog he was. President Jeb Bush declared his re-election victory early, in August, before the machines were fully programmed, but the results were nevertheless assured. President Jeb accepted a call from Hillary Carey Gore, the virtual candidate put up as quadrennial opponent, designed to lose, who always made the same moving concession speech, written for her by Karl Rove. The official voting won't take place until November.
Our nation,
Vice President Kate Harris assures us,
is safer and more prosperous than at any time in our history.
But there are dissenters from this happy new America shivering in their basements, Michaelites with their icons of St. Moore. The film director Holy Man was martyred when, through a rapid expansion caused by self-righteousness and fried food, he simply exploded on stage at the 2011 Cannes Film Festival, a fitting end given his final film, I Hate the Bushes So Much I Could Explode. There are few complaints, certainly none expressed openly after the health insurance riots of 2009, when the last licensed union members were removed to Guantanamo. Orange Suit City is now America's eighth largest metropolis, safer and more prosperous than ever. Still, every morning, the Rio Grande chokes with swarms of obese, illiterate Texans waiting across on their way to their 70-cents-an-hour jobs in the maquiladoras of Juarez. Now, more than ever, America is the Lord's land. Walmart's super megastores have metastasized into monumental retail cathedrals, where true believers in cheap and disposable appliances come to pray and pay. And we are well entertained. We have 11,000 TV channels, with every program chosen personally by Rupert Murdoch's brain, now wired up in a pickle jar on the desk of Fox Network president Roger Ailes. Tonight, Bill Clinton launches his fourth autobiography, with even more whoppers than the last three. I was born in a log cabin mobile home. I did not sleep with that woman, Hillary. The sovereign government of Iraq is still holed up, as it has been for the past decade in the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. This week, Iraq's President du jour declared his own re-election victory. Iraq is safer and more prosperous today than at any time in Iraqi history, he said, as mortar rounds whumped into the compound. And back in the USA, after curfew, one can hear the screams and cries of the tots in the workhouses, locked behind the menacing signs, No Child's Behind Left. Democracy flourishes. Yesterday, President Bin Laden of Eurasia also reelected himself and received a congratulatory phone call from President Bush. How long can we keep this up? Whispered Osama. Our president replied,
just as long as the boobs and the rednecks and berserkers and believers stay whipped up and angry. Forever and ever, partner.
Nameless barbarians will assassinate the president tomorrow, or will appear to. It's all in the plan, where made-for-TV dramas and news are switched as needed to titillate the numbed public. President Bush died like the cowardly dog he was, the, quote, terrorists, will say. And another Bush will replace him, vowing to fight the unseen enemy in a war without end nor hope of an end. If my report from the future gives you the creeps, the present ain't a joyride either. The day before I wrote this, Carlos Arredondo, 44, of Miami, Florida, jumped into a military van, dumped out a 5-gallon canister of gasoline over himself, and lit it, burning up half his body. Minutes before, the MPs who stopped the van at his house told him his only son was shot dead in Iraq. Neighbors said Arredondo went crazy. I don't think so. I think he went sane. What's insane is a regime that grants no asylum from militarized greed, whose sole saving grace is its incompetence. If they knew what they were doing, it would be worse. Arredondo put into action the wisdom of my late teacher, Allen Ginsberg. The soul, he wrote, should not die ungodly in an armed madhouse.
Coming up next, Chris Hedges interviewed by Charles Gillette. Chris Hedges discusses the ignorance of John McCain, the media's ignoring and whitewashing of the horrors of battle, the mythic narrative of war as honor and glory, the danger of war with Iran, and the rise of Pat Robertson-style Christian right nationalists. Chris Hedges, currently a senior fellow at the Nation Institute
in New York City and a lecturer in the Council of Humanities and Distinguished Fellow at Princeton University, spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. Hedges, who reported from more than 50 countries, worked for the Christian Science Monitor, the National Public Radio, the Dallas Morning News, and the New York Times, where he spent 15 years. He is author of the best-selling book, War is a Force, that gives us meaning, which draws on his various experiences in conflicts to describe the patterns and behaviors of nations and individuals in wartime. This book was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction. And here is Chris Hedges.
This is talk show host Charles Goyette from KFNX with another special feature from my Phoenix radio show for antiwar.com. Chris Hedges is it was a distinguished foreign correspondent. He spent a couple of decades with the New York Times. I don't know that there's been a hot spot on the globe that he didn't visit in that capacity. He's the author of a book I found enormously enlightening called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He also wrote What Every Person Should Know About War. He's seen it from the inside out. He is also a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School. His most recent book is called American Fascists, The Christian Right, and the War on America. Chris Hedges in Princeton, New Jersey this morning. Good morning. Thank you for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Hey, can you comment at all on the representation by Senator McCain? It's a story for us here on this show because he is, our senior snowy-haired senator from Arizona.
You mean, sort of defending the surge in Iraq?
Well, it even goes beyond that. It's not just defending the surge. That may not be news because he's been doing that since the idea was first floated. But he's making wild speculations and representations. In fact, I want to let you hear one of them right now. Just wild representations about the conditions that prevail on the ground in Baghdad.
There are neighborhoods in Baghdad where you and I.